Good afternoon. It's 2:05, Thursday, April 2nd, 2015. Here at the committee today, Senate Finance in Juneau at Alaska State Capitol, Senator Dunleavy, welcome. Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman. Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
And myself, Senator McKinnon. On today's agenda, we have Senate Bill 71, Vaccine Certification for Pharmacists, as well as SB 86, Refined Fuel Surcharge Motor Fuel Tax. Is there anything to come before the committee? Seeing that, I'd like to ask Senator Giesel and Jane Conway to present Senate Bill 71. Senator Giesel, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm State Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. So Senate Bill 71, will expand the scope of authority for Alaska pharmacists to independently administer all vaccines and would reduce some burdensome collaborative practice agreements. Now, to be clear, some collaborative practice agreements are a good thing. I hope to, by the end of a few comments, demonstrate why this particular one is not necessary. Currently, Alaska pharmacists require the oversight by a medical doctor or nurse practitioner to oversee their immunization authority. Some pharmacies have difficulty finding a collaborative physician or nurse practitioner, and this in turn reduces access to vaccines. So Senate Bill 71 would give already trained and certified pharmacists the authority to immunize Alaska adults and children without having to contract with sometimes hard-to-find physicians or nurse practitioners to oversee their programs. Since 2005, all pharmacists are fully trained in immunization procedures as part of their education program. Pharmacists who went to their education program before 2005 would be required to take an immunization training program approved by the Board of Pharmacy. This is clearly stated in the bill. Pharmacist education and training includes the evaluation of appropriate drug therapy, dosing, and monitoring for adverse events. I will add here, if I'm prescribing a medication and I have any question about side effects, drug interactions, etc., the person I call is a pharmacist because that is their area of specialization. This bill is going to be particularly helpful in rural areas where the populations often see their pharmacist more often than they would see a medical professional. Pharmacy hours are much more convenient than healthcare providers' hours in that they're open on weekends, holidays, evenings, etc. Studies show that in states where pharmacists have this authority to administer medications have much higher immunization rates, and we are the lowest in the U.S., by the way, Madam Chair. All vaccinations that would be administered by a pharmacist would be reported to the centralized data program statewide, which is called VacTrack. So it goes into the statewide database. In 2013, Alaska pharmacists administered over 13,000 flu vaccines, and this legislation would allow them to have access to provide even more vaccinations to the Alaska public. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions from committee members on Senate Bill 71? Thank you for that testimony. We have a few people that are wishing to testify from the general public. I could ask you to move away from the mic so that we can bring them forward. The public hearing is open on Senate Bill number 71, an act relating to the practice of pharmacy and relating to the administration of vaccines and related emergency medications. Here in the room, we have Scott Watts. Scott, if you could approach the microphone, identify yourself for the record, and please provide 3 minutes of testimony.
Hi, for the record, my name is Scott Watts. I'm a Juneau resident and a pharmacist here in Juneau. I'm here to thank you for hearing this bill and also definitely here in support of Senate Bill 71. There were a couple statistics that were listed here just previously that Alaska is very low in the rankings for immunizations, flu, definitely for flu immunizations. Pharmacists can and are helping to increase that. As was stated, pharmacists are currently trained in immunizations. We're acting as resources out there for the public on different immunizations, travel schedules, and so forth. Increased vaccination rate will lower or does help to lower the cost of healthcare in the state, and by passing Senate Bill 71, we can help, like I said, increase those immunizations, and the slight cost of this bill is going to be well offset by the health savings from immunizations. And again, that the financial note on this bill is a one-time note. The way I understand it, and the health benefits is going to continue yearly for from here on out once this is passed, if we can do that. I thank you for your time, and I hope we can pass this bill, I guess.
Mr. Watts, thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson. I apologize, Senator Olson. He's been here for most of the meeting. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Watts, thank you very much for coming forth this morning. Obviously, being a pharmacist, you're busy. People are in demand. But one of the things that has you've talked about being adequately trained. The bill points that out, as well as the sponsor statement. You know as well as I do that there are several ways to go ahead and take immunizations. One is injection. That's the one people mostly are familiar with. But there's also PO. Taking the immunization by the oral means. You pointed out that the training that you take, I guess one of the, you know, people can take pills, people can go ahead and give shots and do whatever else, but the one in the very low percentage of adverse reactions that goes out there, I guess one of the real problems that I have is that if for some reason somebody has the worst of the bunch, which is the anaphylaxis, that has an anaphylactic shock and a reaction to one of those things, There is the perception, and most people are right, that you can go ahead and try and stop it by giving them a dose of epinephrine. And most people go ahead and do that. But past that, if there's no reaction, or if the airway has already closed, you're dealing with a situation that somebody is going to need an intubation. And somebody breathing for them, as well as the ability to go ahead and have them to defibrillate them if it gets to that stage. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when that happens, it's a very trying thing to endure, especially if it's a child. I guess what I was just trying to get the idea of what breadth of training has a pharmacist like yourself has if somebody has an extreme case of anaphylaxis.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator. There is a protocol for the epinephrine injections, and we are required to be CPR certified for anybody administering the vaccinations. And this is also spelled out. Currently, pharmacists are, I think you heard the number of vaccines that pharmacists have administered. So this has already been spelled out in protocols that have been signed off by physicians. So there will not be any difference. There will be the same training that is required by the physicians. It just is relieving the burdensome protocol from the physicians.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Scott, I don't think mm-hmm. that most physicians would agree that you have the same training as a physician. You got physicians out there that are able to intubate, and I'm sure you haven't been able to, or been trained to do that, and maybe you have. I don't know. But I would say that a large percentage of pharmacists are not trained to intubate people.
Senator Olson, could we have a brief at ease?
Sure.
on the record. Senator Olson.
The point has to do with whether, I think you made the comment that you've had the same training as physicians, and I beg to disagree that most physicians probably don't have that perspective. And I pointed out that there are certainly paramedics and people like that that can go ahead and intubate, but most pharmacists that I know, and there are very few pharmacists out in rural Alaska, and I doubt that they have intubation, either experience or training. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that, I guess, let me step back, that I was in no means implying that we have the same training as physicians. We do not intubate. I don't have any training for that by any means. That's not it at all.
One of the comments that was also made was that there seems to be a lack of, and that Alaska does indeed lag way behind in vaccines. And it's not that I'm opposed to vaccines. There is certainly that, and the Health and Social Services has numbers that go ahead and back that up. But part of the reason is there's this perception that vaccines, especially taken in multiple sequences over a very short period of time, one has adverse reactions with the increase that we've seen in sudden death syndrome, and autism has been more the one, although those studies have generally been debunked. Am I still on the right track as far as what your experience has been?
Through the chair, Senator, I would agree with you that I definitely agree with you at that point, yes.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you for joining us today in Senate Finance. We're heading to the Fairbanks LIO. Margaret Soden. Margaret, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to Senate Finance. If you could identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with 3 minutes of testimony.
Thank you very much. I'm Margaret Soden. I live in Fairbanks, and I am a community pharmacist. Just recently retired. I practiced here in Fairbanks for over 40 years. In a community setting, I'm very supportive of allowing pharmacists, of course, with the proper training and certification, to administer immunizations without the oversight of a medical doctor or nurse practitioner. Since many of us work in the community and our pharmacies are often open in the evenings and on weekends, we are accessible and available. Also, we see patients more often than other practitioners because they return to the pharmacy to refill their prescriptions, shop for health care sundries, or just perhaps come in and visit or seek our advice on any number of things. And when that happens, we are the people that we can stand there and we can say, have you had your vaccinations? How are you feeling? What's going on in your life? So we can encourage them to get their necessary immunizations, and those of us that are trained can administer them immediately if needed and after we've done a health survey. By allowing pharmacists to independently administer vaccines, more pharmacies will offer this service to their patients, and thus more Alaskans will be immunized. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Margaret, for joining Senate Finance. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, off net we have Amber Briggs. Ms. Briggs, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Amber Briggs. I am a pharmacist at Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna. I have practiced in multiple practice settings over the years in community practice, hospital, long-term care, and ambulatory care. I have personally administered thousands of vaccinations of many different sorts over the years, and I'm also a trainer for the immunization program that is offered in our state at this time. I wanted to speak a little bit about the financial impact of directly related to adverse outcomes of not providing immunizations. One component of the financial impact is directly related to the burden of preventable adverse patient outcomes. And the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality reports, and unfortunately the most current data I have is 2008-2009, reports that 2009 emergency department visits from H1N than influenza were 417.5 per 100,000, up from 161.8 per 100,000 in 2008. Hospitalizations per 100,000 were 53.1 in 2009, up from 29.1 in 2008. And the cost of inpatient stays was 11,000, up from 8,500 in 2008. So what I'm basically saying is that we are reducing healthcare costs in the long run as for allowing pharmacists to be able to independently administer immunizations. We're highly trained in the area of drugs, and vaccinations are drugs. We're also trained, part of the program, to be emergency responders. Although we are not able to intubate, we have the training to be able to sustain life through basic life support until emergency services can arrive. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony today.
Ms. Briggs, thank you for joining us from Soldotna. We appreciate that. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, off-net, Ryan Ruggles. Mr. Ruggles?
Good afternoon, everybody. Hello, and thank you, Madam Chair, and the entire committee for taking the time to listen today. For the record, my name is Ryan Ruggles. I'm the District Pharmacy Manager for Core Safeway here in Alaska. I want to echo what other people have said. You know, prevention is the key to a healthy society. Immunization is one way that we can definitely help to achieve that. I wanted to highlight that pharmacy-based immunization is safe, convenient, economical, and effective. In most cases, it's very convenient for patients to walk in and receive their vaccines. I apologize. During my introduction, I am also a pharmacist. I do have pharmacies across the state, and we do administer a lot of vaccines currently under collaborative practice agreements. And I would like to also highlight and echo that I think it will be more cost-effective to administer vaccines through community pharmacy as opposed to a doctor's office. The cost of the vaccine is all it's charged. There's no office visit. And in fact, sometimes we still see patients bring us prescriptions, and we still end up administering the vaccine for those patients via prescription from a provider. So I guess in the current model, the collaborative practice agreement is with the PIC and the specific location. So if there is a manager change, it does eliminate the possibility of giving vaccinations to that general population until we can obtain another collaborative practice agreement, which needs to be approved and occasionally can take anywhere. I've seen it take between 3 and 6 months at times due to reaching the provider and getting the approval. I just wanted to end with the thought that my ultimate goal is to keep Alaskans as healthy and happy as they can be. I think that the Senate Bill 71 is definitely taking a step towards that. Thank you, everybody, for listening to me. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggles. Are there questions from committee members? I have one. As someone who's representing Cars Safeway, you currently provide some shots on location. Is that correct?
We provide everything that, except for yellow fever.
And so do you have a doctor that you contract with that allows you to do that now?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
For the record, it's a nurse practitioner at this point through our collaborative practice agreement.
And can you disclose the cost of that?
The cost of the collaborative practice agreement with each provider is very different. I know it would be difficult to say. I personally don't know the cost right offhand. However, I do know that it can range drastically by hundreds of dollars depending on which provider you are in contract with.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggles. Any additional questions from committee members? I did want to advise the committee as well as those in the audience that we do have Division of Health Care Services online, Aaron Narse, if we have questions for the department. Following, heading to Ketchikan off net, Barry Christensen. Mr. Christensen, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Members of the Senate Finance Committee, my name is Barry Christensen, and I am a second-generation pharmacist in Ketchikan. Today I'm addressing you as a co-chair of the Alaska Pharmacists Association Legislative Committee on behalf of our association. We represent pharmacies, pharmacists, and pharmacy technicians in the state of Alaska. Our members work hard every day serving fellow Alaskans in retail, pharmacies, hospitals, nursing homes, and clinic settings throughout the state. We are asking for your support today for this legislation, which we feel would significantly improve access to vaccinations and public health as a result. We understand that your committee has a responsibility to ensure that state dollars are spent well. However, we feel that the $50,000 fiscal note attached to the bill by Alaska Medicaid can be easily justified if, for example, pharmacies are able to vaccinate, say, an additional 12 people for flu or pneumonia that would have not been vaccinated and instead were hospitalized with illness. The Center for Disease Control has indicated that for every dollar spent on vaccinations, $10 in healthcare costs are ultimately saved. In closing, this legislation has the support of small mom-and-pop pharmacies, larger chain pharmacies, and the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy. Lise Houchin, who's our partner with the National Association of Trade Drugstores, was unable to testify today, but their letter of support is in your packet. We are asking for this legislation to help keep Alaskans healthy, which will ultimately lower costs to the state of Alaska. Thank you for your favorable consideration of this legislation.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. Christensen. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Is there anyone else off net, online, wishing to testify on Senate Bill 71? Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Bill 71? If you approach the microphone and identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jason Tapley, and I'm a community pharmacist here.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm in favor of Senate Bill 71. I just recently moved here from Western North Carolina about 3 weeks ago, and that state also has a collaborative practice agreement, but I noticed difficulty with my patients in the area. Transporting them to the pharmacy, to the doctor's office, anywhere from their house was a big deal in terms of paying for gasoline and just having the time to do that. And a lot of times with certain disabilities, it just made it extremely difficult. So this would increase access to care because the times they usually go out, they try and knock everything out all at once. So go to the doctor, then go to the pharmacy, and then go home or go grab groceries. By doing this, they would be able to receive any vaccines they needed without having to make another trip to the physician to get a new prescription or to see if they needed that vaccine. Pharmacists could handle all that insight. Thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you for coming out and following the bill. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tapley, thanks for coming to Alaska, especially from North Carolina. I'm sure it was quite the shock or quite the difference setting than we have down there than we have here. One of the questions, obviously, is if for some reason there's an adverse reaction. That's everybody's concern. People can go ahead and take something by mouth. They can and be injected. But guess in your facility, what type of, and you're one of the more modern trained or closely trained, I mean, somebody that was trained maybe 40 years ago didn't have the training that you've had. Can you just kind of encapsulate not so much the training that you've had, but training is good, but unless you have resources there that are able to go ahead and meet the situation, what kind of equipment do you have to go ahead and address these adverse reactions?
Sure. Most pharmacies, any ones of the ones that I've been in, we are all trained in basic life support, and then we also have EpiPens in stock, as well as Benadryl, so anything that would be needed in the short term until EMTs or ambulance could be obtained.
But you don't have a laryngoscope or anything like that?
No.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Bill number 71? Anyone online? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing for Senate Bill 71 is closed. I've asked the committee to set 71 aside. Senator Giesel, did you want to approach the microphone and give us any additional comments?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a couple points to clarify. First of all, the collaborative practice agreements that are in place right now are the contracts that you asked about. They've been in place. They were put in place in 1989. This is a long time ago, Madam Chair. Healthcare has changed, and healthcare education has changed. These healthcare professionals that we call pharmacists today earn PhDs. That's the level of entry into this profession. They have pharmacy doctoral degrees, so they are highly educated. I would also add, Madam Chair, that I have administered vaccinations and travel immunizations in numerous settings. I have intubated a few times in emergency rooms, but by and large, those settings, there's no one available who has extensive training in intubation, which is a highly refined skill, Madam Chair, which requires repeated repetition to remain competent. So it's extremely rare that someone would have to be intubated, and EMS is very readily available in most settings. So just to give the committee some comfort there. That was all. Thank you so much for hearing the bill today.
I have questions from committee members.
Certainly.
So, Senator Dunleavy, followed by Senator Bishop and Senator Olds.
Thank you. Senator Giesel, can you talk to the fiscal note?
Yes, I can. Well, I will attempt to, pardon me, not being a finance committee member.
Given that we're in a process of reducing in this.
Absolutely. So first of all, there is the fiscal note. I don't know how you guys identify these, but it's for $2,500, 2.5. This will be borne by the department and the pharmacists, because this is a self-supporting board, just like all the other regulatory boards. The big one you're probably interested in is the capital piece, which is $50,000. So as I look at that, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I go to the single audit that was just completed on the state of Alaska, and I go to the Department of Health and Human Services section, where it is documented the extensive system deficits and known non-compliance in many of the sections of our Medicaid Management Information Services, and the overpayments, underpayments, etc. Well, in brief, Senator Dunleavy, that system that we use for Medicaid to enroll, to pay providers, is going to require extensive renovation, frankly, starting probably from ground zero. This $50,000 will be part of what we're already going to have to do. So I don't mean to minimize $50,000, but I believe that it will be an integrated part of what we already have to do with our Medicaid system.
Madam Chair, on that point.
Senator Olson, on that point.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I agree with Senator Giesel that there's something called herd immunity that's out there, and that's why Measles got the head start that it did. $2,500 is a drop in the bucket, and the $50,000 has to be paid for anyway. So I totally agree with her assessment of, and we are getting very, if we can find more people to get immunized, we are far ahead with what's going on under this scenario with the fiscal note we have. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dunleavy, follow up. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Giesel, there's been some discussion around the administration of emergency medical practices if somebody has an adverse reaction. Is there data in Alaska that where we've got an experience rate that we've tracked in this state? Do you know of any data set out there? It's not a deal breaker for me, but I just kind of like to know for my own curiosity.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, let me clarify the question. Are you asking about severe adverse reactions
yes.
to vaccinations?
Yes. And Yes.
I couldn't, to the point of inability to breathe, I could not give you that data, and frankly, I'd have to look up the data for just general adverse reactions. The problem is identifying what is an adverse reaction and was it connected to a vaccination.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the sponsor of SB 71, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Obviously, this is a very important piece of legislation, Senator Geisel. I was wondering if you had any, if you heard from any of the health corporations, the native health corporations, especially out in rural Alaska, if they were in favor of it or not.
I have, through the chair, Senator Olson, I have not. But great question, and I will follow up on that.
And if I could, Madam Chair, what about the administration? Is Health and Social Services in favor of this bill?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I do not know. Sorry.
The last two questions have to do more with physicians. Obviously, turf war has been one of the things that's been going on for a long time. You're very familiar with it. I'm familiar with it. I come from a rural area where we're heavy dependent on mid-levels like yourself. And so as we look at this, I was wanting to see if you'd heard anything from the Alaska State Medical Association, which is a private organization, as well as the medical board.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I have not heard any negative feedback from those two organizations.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson, thank you. Thank you, Senator Geisel. We have Aaron Nurse from the Division of Health Care Services. Would you like, that state of Alaska, would we like to ask them if the administration is in favor of the legislation? Senator Olson.
I'm sorry?
Would you like to ask the administration? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, if they're available, if they have the ability to go ahead and speak to it. They may not have a position on it already, but if they do, I'd like to hear what it is.
Aaron Nurse, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Aaron Nurse. I'm with a pharmacist with the Division of Healthcare Services. And Dr. Olson, or Senator Olson, through the chair, in regards to a position on the bill, the department doesn't have a specific position on it, but if you had questions specifically related to the fiscal note, I'd be able to answer those for you.
The only question I have, Madam Chairman, has to do with the fiscal note. Are we pretty much in agreement that the fiscal note is what it has stated with Senator Geisel and myself to answer Senator Dunleavy's question, that indeed is what the case is? If I could be more specific, Madam Chairman, if you're not understanding the question, the fiscal note says $2,500, which I think is a drop in the bucket for the coverage we're going to do to try and cover the herd immunity, as well as the $50,000 is going to be a necessary expense anyway that we are going to have to withstand as a legislature. Is that correct, Madam?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the with regards to the fiscal note for the system's updates to ensure our compliance with 42 CFR 455.410, which is a requirement to require all ordering providers to be enrolled with Medicaid, that is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. No further questions.
Thank you, Senator Olson. With that, I'd like to set Senate Bill 71 aside and ask the committee for a brief at ease.
Welcome, Senate Finance. It is 3:30 on April 2nd. We're going to finish up on HB 73 and HB 72, the operating budgets. We have just a couple amendments today to go through. And when we do it, our capable Mr. Armstrong will be walking us through the some of these amendments. Can we get a motion on amendment number 24, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 24.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Armstrong?
Amendment number 24 is a language section. I'm sorry, for the record, James Armstrong, staff to Senator Kelly. In section C of the operating budget before you in House Bill 72, the appropriation dealing with K through 12 is reduced by $983 million, and it is now estimated to be about $151 million. And then the second part of the amendment, I'll come back to section C, is it amends the K through 12 appropriation contained in last year's operating budget, reduces that by $200 million. So what you have is appropriation combining with what's in the permanent education fund and the $151 million appropriated in FY16 for total K through 12 funding of $1 billion. So that would prorate K-12 education at 95.9%.
For the listening audience, the mechanics of the two funds that we have for education, or the forward funding that we have for education, we needed to reduce the 15 account and then move money over to the 16 account and then fund at a percentage level lower than was anticipated. The $983 million is not a reduction to education, neither is the $151 million or anything like that. James, what was the total number for the K-12 formula? Did you say it was 1.3?
It was 1.134 in the bill.
Okay, 1.1.
It goes down to 151.
The amount that is being funded.
The amount being funded in FY16 is $1,151,000,000,
okay,
which equates to 95.9%.
Right. So, is the committee up to speed on that? Senator Olson, you have a question?
What I'm seeing here, let me just make sure I got it correctly, because I'm trying to look at the numbers, and since it's the first time I've seen it, it's true that instead of the BSA being fully funded, there's a diminished amount to that in the neighborhood of $151 million. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Armstrong, go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the BSA would be reduced in FY16 by $49 million.
Okay.
And that is the total reduction for FY16. This amendment would also there would be no forward funding. The public education fund would have no money for FY17. The legislature would
cut the money be put in the CBR.
Yeah, the money would go. The CBR draw would be less.
Right.
So next year the legislature would fund K through 12 education through the appropriate, or not the appropriate, the practice before the public education fund was adopted 10 years ago.
Senator Olson, I'm going to take at ease, and then Mr. Armstrong can walk you through that if you want to ask a few more questions.
You don't mind, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I want to make sure everyone understands it well. We'll take a brief at ease.
back on the record. Senator Olson, that was a good explanation. You're up to speed on that?
I'm up to speed.
Okay. So I think the important thing to note here is that we've never been in fiscal times like this, and nothing can be beyond scrutiny. And education, we want to protect as much as possible, and we've taken some steps to make sure that the reduction to education is minimal compared with some of the other reductions that we've had to take this year. Next year, if the price of oil doesn't turn around, next year is going to be even a little more scary. One of the things that we are concerned about, and we're going to talk about this after the meeting, we're going to go through these amendments and have a little more of a dialogue between members, but one of the things that is particularly concerning is the fact that there was a deal made with Iran today, and production, oil production globally could be going up rather soon, and that will have downward pressure on Alaska's price of oil and our budget, obviously. So we want to make sure that it's possible in the next few weeks we can see downward pressure on oil prices. We're going to need room in conference committee if we have to make some corrections. And some of the actions we're taking here over the last couple of days have been to make sure that we can have an ongoing conversation later in the session, even though the close is coming at us rapidly. We want to be able to discuss these kinds of things and possibly find some savings in conference committee. We won't be able to do that if we don't take these actions at this table. But like I said, we're going to have a little more lengthy discussion on that after these amendments. And well, that's about it for now. So we'll move to the back to the amendment. It's still before us. There is objection. Is there continued objection? Senator McKinnon, did you? I'm going to remove my objection. With that, Senate Amendment number 24 has passed. It brings before us Amendment number 25. Mr. Armstrong?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment number 25.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Armstrong?
Amendment number 25 deals with the legislature's budget. It creates a new two separate allocations. In the years past, all of the state facilities rent that the legislature pays has always been under one allocation. This separates it out and creates a new allocation for the property on Anchorage, 716 West 4th Avenue, and it funds that for FY16 at 7 months, and it has some intent language that says lease payments are valid or good through January 2016. And then the rest of the rent that the legislature pays is in the separate appropriations statewide. So,
Mr. Armstrong, if you just explain the amendment, and if we have other questions on that, we can.
That's the explanation of the amendment. Right. And there's more of a narrative on the back on page two.
I'm going to remove my objection. Are there other objections? Hearing none, Amendment 25 is passed. Amendment number 26. I move Amendment number 26. Is there objection? Okay. I can explain this, Mr. Armstrong. This is language that we need in the budget. It's kind of a self-defense mechanism. The different branches of government need to protect themselves, and we will continue through the different committees discussing Medicaid expansion, but we want to make sure it can't be unilaterally done by one of the branches of government. So this language may or may not protect us from that, is an attempt to protect us from that, and we will further discuss this at conference. If we don't put this amendment in there, whatever was in the bill already, which I thought was inadequate to protect us from a unilateral expansion of Medicaid, would be the law of the land, essentially. So this will continue to conference. So any questions on that? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, or Madam, Mr. Chairman. One of the specific questions has to do with what are the exact effects on the efforts to go ahead and expand Medicaid that the governor has been so adamant about?
He has, his avenue is the bill that is currently in Hess, and I've been told it's going to be moving out pretty soon. I think there is a bill in the House as well, and so his avenue will be those bills.
Okay, so this in no way enables that?
It doesn't affect those bills in the least.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is the objection removed? Having no objection, amendment number 26 is passed. Senator Olson, we had amendments number 17, A and B. And Senator, just for everyone's benefit here, Senator Olson and I discussed the possibility and the ability that we have to enact his legislation in his amendment in conference committee. So if you, Senator Olson, if you'd like to, you could withdraw that. If not, we can move it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have 17 A and B. I've got 17 and 18. Is that?
My apologies. 17 and 18. You're right.
I withdraw amendment number 17, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection to withdrawing amendment number 17? Hearing none, 17 is withdrawn. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I go ahead and withdraw amendment number 18.
Is there objection to withdrawing amendment number 18? Hearing none, amendment number 18 is withdrawn. Senator Bishop. Senator Bishop, you want to brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
We're back on the record. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion.
Go ahead.
I move and ask unanimous consent under Uniform Rule 31A that the Senate Finance Committee rescind its previous action of adopting Amendments 7, 29, GH178/S.1 and 29, GH178/2/N.1 and 7B.
Is there objection?
Object.
Thank
Senator
you.
Bishop, if you could speak to your motion, and you'll have latitude to
thank you,
Mr. speak Chairman. Broadly.
Members of the committee, a year ago, it's no mystery what my background is. A year ago, we had a bill before this committee that it was the governor's sponsored bill through an elder statesman here in the Senate, and at that time I expressed my concerns with that bill at this very table. And what I said was the legislature's job is to approve or not approve a contract, vote to monetary terms, let the administration and the appropriate collective bargaining entities, the individual unions, if you will, negotiate. Because any time you attempt for an outside third party to get into attempt to influence a negotiation, it has, we don't have all the information. We have empirical information. And we don't know all the ins and outs of those negotiations. So that's why I was adamantly opposed to that last year. This is a little bit different animal. The legislature has the authority. There's Supreme Court decisions to fund or not fund. It's in case law. But the whole point of my argument here today is we've talked a lot about the price of oil. It's a different world than we were a year ago. We all know we're in tough times. Just recently, as 3 minutes ago, you talked about a tentative deal with Iran and why you needed flexibility to maybe negotiate a conference committee. I have been working 3 years with individual bargaining units, talking to them about the realities of the physical climate we're in. They understand that. I used my own life's experiences in 1985 in Prudhoe Bay when oil went to $9 a barrel. We had to open our collective bargaining agreement, and I had to take a $9 an hour pay cut between wages and benefits. But we did that. We did it in good faith. I'm not implying that this is not in good faith, but we have a bargain unit that is in negotiations today that has asked for 0, 0, and 0 over 3 years, and they recognize the climate that we're in. And I just think by this action, now that it taints the water a little bit for further negotiations with future contracts, and so that's why I'm opposed and asked to rescind those motions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I think you've articulated your position well, and I don't want to dispute it, because you have brought up pretty much the reasons why we find ourselves in this situation. And we do need some leverage at conference committee. We are nervous about the future of oil prices. And to go beyond that would be disputing what you said, and I said I wasn't going to do that. So I can't support your motion, but I thank you for bringing it forward. And I know you have done some work over the last 3 years, and we certainly appreciate it, because you are a great bridge to the collective bargaining agencies. Any other comments? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I looked at this, I was flat out surprised when it came through the table yesterday, and wasn't prepared to go ahead and wasn't prepared, although I didn't necessarily support it outright, because it's such a drastic move to go ahead and have it happen. And as we look at some of the negotiations that have been going on, although years of work that have gone into it, where concessions have been made on both sides of the situation. And we as a sitting and policymakers have got to weigh on both sides. Senator Bishop has been very good as far as trying to go ahead and articulate. But, you know, I want to bring it down to the level of the families that are out there that are affected by this, because we see, you know, half a dozen or more groups of employees that are affected. And these families, you know, have made plans and have thought about what they're going to be doing with the income that's coming at their way. More specifically, those students that these kids that are in these families, have schools have been selected for them to go to, tuition, so they could pay for their tuition and things like that. And so from, I guess, the human standpoint, I find it difficult to go ahead and not support this amendment, and therefore I'm going to be voting with Senator Bishop on this.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Call the roll, please.
Senator Bishop?
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Cheeky?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
No.
Senator McKinnon?
No.
So the motion to rescind our action on the amendments 7B. Thank you. Has failed. So as I said before, that's it in our amendment packet, isn't it, James? Yeah. Okay. Thought it was valuable that we take a little bit of time to discuss the situation that we find ourselves in. I mentioned a little bit of it earlier when we were talking about the education amendment. These are unusual times. $4 billion hit in 16, $3.5 billion hit in 15, and uncertainty about the price of oil and whether it'll even stabilize at this inadequate level. And so we've had to take some actions that many of us didn't like, but we were put in a position to take those actions, because that's just our time in history, and we have to respond in the best interest of the state. It is with no joy that we did anything that might impact families. I think we were pretty good about not impacting families. Most of the positions that we saw come across this table that were impacted as far as budget cuts were concerned, the actual job positions were phantom positions. There weren't very many positions that were actually occupied by Alaskans. We tried to keep many of the grants that were going. We tried to keep them going. We tried to be attentive to Medicaid, health and social services, certainly education, the university. But really no one was held sacrosanct in this process. But we did prioritize to have the least impact on Alaskans. As we go forward, we will have conference committee discussions, and some of the actions of this committee will give us leverage as we deal with the other body to respond to changing conditions that may even happen between now and 2 weeks from now as far as the price of oil is concerned. I'm pretty proud of this budget, and before we go off and talk to the amendments or to the bill that's actually been drafted, I wanted to thank a lot of the people that were involved in this up to their Adam's apples, and they did a fantastic job. And of course, over at Ledge Finance, David, Amanda, Rob, Lacey, Danith, Kelly, and Alexia from the Legislative Finance Group, Megan Wallace at Ledge Drafting, Pat Pitney. Are you here, Pat? No, she's not here. Of course, she works with the governor's office, but she was a delight to work with. And though Karen Rayfield could never be replaced, I think Pat came pretty close. Donnie, Marta, Laura, Danae, Allison, appreciate your help. You guys always do such a good job for us. Erin, nobody ever thanks Erin. She's always here. We're here at late night. Guess what? You look over there, and Erin's there. Sometimes Brock is there with her, and they switch out the camera people. Laura with Senator McKinnon's staff, Tim with Senator Hoffman's staff, Denise with Senator Olson's staff, Stella and Joan with Senator Dunleavy's staff, Mike with Senator Bishop, and Larry with Senator Chickie. And, of course, the man, James Armstrong, really helped me out, obviously, did a lot more than just help me out. He's the structure of the budget if you're going to build one. So with that, thank you all. You did a great job, and I think we have a lot to be proud of. But I think it's time to hear from some of the members about what you think. Senator McKinnon? Oh, Senator McKinnon, I think you wanted to make a quick motion before you spoke. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to publicly disclose my close economic relationship and conflict of interest regarding my husband's association with the Construction Education Foundation that receives money from the state of Alaska through the Department of Labor.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. We will require you to vote if it comes to that. That is our way here, because everyone has a conflict in this state. Somehow the budget is so big and there are so few people. We all have a conflict of some kind. Senator McKinnon, did you want to comment as co-chair?
Mr. Chairman, it's difficult times that we as Alaskans are facing, and as you've stated, this is not an easy thing to do, to cut $400 million or close to that from a budget that feeds Alaska families is heart-wrenching, but it is the fiscally responsible thing to do for this state. We have to eliminate, looking forward in our future, reoccurring operating costs if we are to significantly decrease the hit to Alaska's savings account. We will be drawing, prior to June 30th of this year, $3.5 billion and eliminating Alaska's statutory budget reserve. Gone. This year. In 2016, which is this year also, beginning on July 1st, we stand to draw another $3.5 billion, and we'll need a vote probably from our constitutional budget reserve to access those funds. Mr. Chairman, it's tough times, but Alaskans are resilient and tough people, and we can do this together. And there are things in here that a lot of people don't like, but they are responsible cuts that try to share the burden in facing our economic reality. And We are resilient. We have opportunities that are out there that we continue to look to. We have a gas pipeline that we are wanting to hold our reserves ready to invest as a partner in a pipeline to bring Alaska's future forward. But we need everybody, union and non-union laborers. And Mr. Chairman, it was a heart-wrenching vote to not go back and fulfill what some are saying is a promise to Alaskans. It's our opportunity to talk to Alaskan families about how rough at least the next 6 to 12 months are going to be, specifically for our savings accounts. And it's absolutely true that we could draw everything from our savings account and just continue on and hope that, like in our past, oil has saved the day. But oil stands not to save the day for Alaska right now. Your finance committee has looked very hard at what is happening in a global economy, and we've talked about that with the price per barrel of oil before. And I look forward to engaging Alaskans in that conversation because we are in a global market right now, and that market is pinching us hard. Mr. Chairman, I stand behind what you and your staff and your team have done to take us through this, to chart a course for the next 365 days, and it's a course that we should be proud of. It's a hard course, and if opportunities change, our budget can change. But right now, this is the right thing to do. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Armstrong, thank you to my staff and team. Thank you to the Senate President's staff. Thank you. Thank you to labor unions who are in our audience now and people that are affected by this budget. We can't do it without everybody, and I appreciate being part of the process and at least ears to listen and a voice to speak for the people of Alaska.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. By the way, I forgot to mention Brett Huber and Pete Feldman, who are here as well. Thank you both. Christine, of course. Senator Machicki?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to use the word proud of this budget. It's a tough job. It's the right thing to do. This is sort of when we earn our keep here, right? This is, I'm a fairly new senator. This is my third year, and it was very different the last 2 years, but we saw this coming, and it's here. And we saw it coming whether or not oil retracted in value by 50%, potentially more. So we began turning this ship around a couple years ago, but certainly as another senator I know says, this is somewhat unprecedented, and we had a lot of work to do. You know, it's tough because since pre-oil, pre-Hammond, when Alaskans were forced to sort of pay their own way, we've not known days like these. We've been blessed by natural resources that have paved the way for us and paid the way for us. We're in different times right now. I say I'm not proud of it because we sweated through every cut. Every cut. I mean, I had the Hess budget. I very much believe in those services. I had DOT, I mean, for the folks that depend on ferry transportation, the marine highway system, if you will. The Hess one's very painful. We all believe in education. Labor, this is unorthodox, but I think, and we should lead the way as legislators. We have to all be equally impacted. I continually say that it's about leadership and teamwork minus parochialism, and I think that's kind of a key issue. We're all going to feel pain. In that pain comes the opportunity. We are not a poor state. We're going to have to make some tough decisions first, reduce our spending significantly, and we're, I don't know, total capital and operating, we're probably 740, 750 right now, $750 million. That's out of a shortfall of $3.5 to $3.7 billion this year and a similar shortfall next year. So we've got a long way to go. One of the things we keep hearing is about promises. The promise I'm making, I'm going to do everything I can to keep from impacting future generations of Alaskans with debt and current generations of Alaskans with spending burden in the form of taxes. We may get there, but we're going to do our best to reduce those costs today first. And that's what this labor's about. It's not a labor of love. It's a labor of necessity. And proud of the committee working together even when we disagree to not eat our own. This is a tough job, and we all realize that. And I'm going to close with the fact that this budget has a long way to go. Let's go into conference. It's going to the floor tonight, likely, and it has a long way to go. We believe this leaves us a little bit of room for making it the best budget possible between the two bodies. And with that, I do thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chairman, the rest of the committee here. This is my first year on finance. You've been good with me, and I hope I've contributed somewhat. And as I close, my staffer, Larry, although the rest of you and I have not had any tension, Larry and I have had a little bit as we work through this process. So, but he's always the best one can have as a staffer. So thanks to everyone.
Any other? Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to dovetail on a couple of comments. You know, this is a good lesson on why you wanted to diversify your economy. Mm-hmm. And I just want to dovetail on what Senator McKinnon said. This wasn't any fun for anybody. And it's especially not fun on the receiving end of this budget. But with that being said, this is why Alaska should galvanize and bring all hands on deck to get our second leg of revenue, and that's monetizing our Alaska's North Slope gas, and to save as much as we can. Because when we get into the feed stage, if and when we get into the feed stage, there's going to be cash calls that are going to start to be made on this budget, and this state needs to stay in a strong cash position. We need to maintain a AAA credit rating so we're not paying a premium for borrowed debt. And I would just encourage all Alaskans to get behind your elected officials and your administration to get over the top with a gas line so we are never in a bind like this ever again with one revenue source. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Further questions or comments? I think, Senator Machicki, you were correct. It's around 730 was the amount if you include what we anticipate will be the capital budget. There's no way to really know yet. Your capital budget is going to be up
Monday.
And that too is a long process, but we hope that after that process has been completed that we'll see somewhere in the neighborhood of a $730 million cut. Now, there's going to be disagreements over that because there's all kinds of ways to count this. We tried to count this in a way that wasn't fair to us so that we didn't get the benefit of one-time money shifts and those kinds of things. These are fairly difficult numbers to achieve here was the goals that we set for ourselves. And so when we say $730 million or in that neighborhood, again, the capital budget will shift a little bit. Those were not, that wasn't taking advantage of the easy stuff. Senator Hoffman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the committee. You know, I think this committee has looked at urban and rural and not tried to make cuts in one area or the other, and I'm glad for that. But the fact of the matter is that this budget, the first $750 million, I'll tell the committee, was you're going to look back at it and this is going to be the easiest cut you're going to make. If we cut another $750 million each year for the next 4 years, we will still have a deficit if the price of oil stays where it's at. And we need to make Alaskans aware that this deficit that we're facing is very, very serious. It is more serious than the average Alaskan can realize. When you have a deficit this large, I think David Teal said it, we can't cut ourselves out of this budget deficit. Sooner or later, we're going to have to look at revenue-generating measures because we don't have enough revenue just to pay for education, pay for debt service, pay for Medicaid. That's all we have money for. So next year, if this year was difficult, next year is going to be twice as difficult. And if we plan on moving in the same direction of cutting $700+ million, it's going to be it's going to take some special working relationships at this table to get that accomplished. Thank you for working with me, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Dunleavy, Senator Olson, did you have a comment?
We'll have Senator Dunleavy go first.
I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank the co-chairs. This is not an easy task. Nobody dreams of being in this position, and you guys have handled this with class. You really have. You know, it's nothing short of a catastrophic collapse in oil prices for Alaska is the bottom line. I mean, this is great for America. It's great for the lower 48. It's devastating for us. You were talking earlier about the agreement with Iran. We don't know what all the details are on that, but if part of that is that they now get to put more oil in the market, it's not going to be any better. It's probably going to be worse. There's some issues already coming out of Oklahoma and on the coast that the capacity to store oil is at capacity. As a matter of fact, they're selling it. I forget the term they use, but the top 5 inches in some of these giant steel holding tanks, the brokers are to try and get as much storage as possible. Strategic reserves all over the world are being filled up. It's an example where technology has unleashed incredible amounts of energy. And every single day, the United States produces more oil than the day before. And this is supposed to keep occurring, even without additional holes in the ground in lower 48, into July and August. At the same time, as you mentioned, if Iran comes online, there's more oil in figuratively, a pipeline. At the same time, when we look back on Alaska, and I've talked with several senators about this, and we debate the details, but in 89, we had 2 million barrels of production when we were in the low double digits in terms of price. Our government was much, much smaller in 89. At the same time, we had Senator Stevens ramping up spending in Alaska. At the same time, we weren't talking about potentially bracking bases. We were actually growing bases. And at the same time, in lower 48, you didn't have natural gas as an alternative to oil. So at the same time, you've got oil being produced in incredible amounts. You've got gas being produced in areas that never thought they could produce gas. So, you know, I don't want to paint an absolute dismal picture. This is an opportunity for, I think, Alaska, as was mentioned, to start to look at diversification. But it's going to take a combination of factors, and we have to do what we're doing now. This is not something that I think we all high-five each other over. This is it's going to affect all of us. So some of us have, for example, kids still in school. I have a 16-year-old in high school in Wasilla. This is going to impact her. This is going to impact every Alaskan. And as Senator Hoffman said, next year, if this is tough, next year is going to be even more difficult. It's going to be a difficult, tough slog to get us where our revenues and our income is going to match our expenditures. I would imagine we're going to be working all summer, many committees will be, in looking at things we've done for the past 40, 50 years, looking at legislation, looking at laws, looking at regulations, and seeing how we can peel some of that back, change things. But we've got to look at our cost drivers. We've got to look at everything, and again, it's not going to be a pretty sight, but you know, it's pretty easy to come to Juneau when oil is increasing in both volume and price. It's easy to spend money. You're everybody's hero, you're everybody's friend, but we picked the lottery in this particular moment, and we either have one or two choices. We can either step up to the plate, or we can run and hide, and this committee, in my opinion, has stepped up to the plate, everybody here. And we'll continue to step up the plate, and we'll take our shots. We'll take our shots, I'm sure, from the press and from the public, and that's just the way it is. But I think in the end, I think we'll look back on this, and I think we'll be part of something that's a little bit better for Alaska as we navigate our way through this. So I want to thank all the folks on the committee, co-chairs especially, and all the staff that worked on this budget. But as was said, this is just part of a continuing process. This budget will go through another couple committees here until it finally hits the floor for both sides to take a look at it. But this is a real serious situation, and real serious measures need to be applied to it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having been here as in the 2000, as you look at the money that's out there, certainly as we look at the expenses that we're up against, I see that without being able to discipline ourselves and discipline the people that are the programs and things that are under us, our CBR is going to be out of money here in a couple of years. And so I feel that Senator McKinnon had talked about this earlier, that you know, we are in a bad situation. The disappointment that I have, though, as far as being able to address the fiscal crisis that we find ourselves in, I haven't heard a lot of discussion related to increasing our revenues. Certainly, we have production out there that's producing a significant percentage of our revenues, but there are other revenue sources. I've had the discussion came up between myself and another majority member here at the table about other revenues that are out there. He outlined six that were there, and so I thought that we will hopefully get that part into the discussion. People don't like to talk about taxes. People don't like talking about doing whatever else, but we're going to have to do something out there that's more uncomfortable than what we're having here. And so with that, I want to make sure we encourage that thinking. I've dealt with the finance co-chair on the House side about what needs to be done. But I think the bottom line that I want to say before I sign off here is that I've been appreciative of the efforts, as was pointed out by Senator Hoffman, that the rural areas have not taken an undue hit according to this. Now, we've taken hits out there, and maybe some people think we have, but because as we look at what's going on here now on the rail bill, on the road system, you've got gas that's, you know, already reaping the benefits of $2 and $3 a gallon out in my village of Gulliver, and certainly even the hubs of Nome, Kotzebue, and Barrow that only get gasoline once a year. They're still paying over $6 a gallon. So in that in line, I just want to thank the fairness that has been shown by members of the committee as well as the co-chairs for what we were up against. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Can I get a motion on the HB 72?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 72 as amended. And I move to direct the Legislative Finance Division and the Legislative Legal Division to make any appropriate conforming or technical changes to the legislation.
Is there objection? Hearing none, HB 72 is moved with committee from committee by motion. HB 73.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 73 as amended from committee. I also move to direct the Legislative Finance Division and the Legislative Legal Division to make any appropriate conforming or technical changes to the legislation.
Is there objection? Hearing none, HB 73 is moved from committee. Senator McKinnon, are we going to go back to...
Brief at ease.
We'll take a brief at ease, and we'll switch out chairman and go back to the bills that we had before us. Please remember to sign the committee reports. Thank you all.
Becky Vorwick, the Associated Press. Senator Kelly, on the education piece, so if I understand this correct, a $47.6 million cut in addition to the one-time money that would come out of the supplemental plus the agency hit and no forward funding for 17.
Correct.
So you mentioned in the new or in the committee hearing that you need to have some leverage going into conference committee. So how much of this, I guess, is something that you believe is necessary and that the, that education can bear, and how much of it is sort of just, this is my term, but how much of this is potentially just shock value to sort of talk about, like, how serious the situation is?
Honestly, the shock value didn't play into it. If you look at the graph regarding our, you know, we used to like to call it a glide path to a safe landing, and we don't have that anymore. We have hopefully a crash path to a survivable landing. And education can't remain out of the cuts because it's too big a piece. And if we only cut away from the day-to-day agency operations, which we did a lot of this year, we can never get the cuts large enough to actually impact impact our reserves in a positive way. So what I talked about, leverage for conference committee, is that we don't currently have those cuts to the formula part of our budget in the House document. And had we just accepted the House document, then it would never be available for us in conference committee. It couldn't even come up. It could if you ever went to, like, open free conference, but that isn't likely. So I guess the point, to make sure I answered your question, is that the shock value really didn't play into it. We're trying to get to a number, and because the crash path is so steep and our time horizon is so short, we have to get dollars now to survive this. And so we took them from education. We took them from a lot of places, but that amendment took it from education as well.
And just to follow up.
Yeah, I guess it did. Oh, it's your recorder's there. You could just do whatever you want.
I think I just forgot my question. Oh, just to follow up. You know, we heard during the committee hearing that it's not going to get any easier next year. So can you talk about the idea behind not forward funding for 17? If we're not able to do it this year, how is it going to be any easier to provide that funding next year?
Well, the money doesn't just go away. It goes to a different place. It's not in the public education fund. Public education fund automatically funds education if the money is in there by law. So we had to pull that money out of there so that we could reduce the amount that you pay in for FY16. It gets complicated because it was actually FY15 budget money. What was my point?
The money doesn't disappear.
The money doesn't disappear.
It's still
thank you. And what was that? You had two parts to that question.
If the choices are difficult this year.
Oh, right.
It'll
be more difficult next year on all the cuts. I think Senator Hoffman brought up that point, and he's correct. Whatever we went through this year, there wasn't a lot of low-hanging fruit. But if you wanted to describe it as low-hanging fruit, that's all gone. And next year, it'll just make it a lot more difficult. We'll be able to fund education because, as I said, that money didn't go away. It's going to be there available for appropriation next year. Pat, if you could direct them to the other people, not just me.
Actually, it might be just me for you, because it's the amendment on the Medicaid expansion.
Okay.
And does including a specific prohibition on the governor doing that, is that an acknowledgement that the governor kind of appears to have the authority to do that on his own?
I don't think he has the authority unless we give it to him. As I said, it's kind of a healthy battle between the branches of government. I couldn't even tell you that this is going to work. But the fact is that we have to establish our position if we don't want him to act unilaterally without and bypass the appropriations process. We have to put it in the language. So that's what it did.
And if he does have that authority, does that give you motivation to get a Medicaid bill through, as well as the motivation from getting the reforms in that you want?
Honestly, they don't. I don't think they're in the same basket. The motivation, whether the governor can do it or not, if he can do it without our authority, without our ascension, that's a whole different battle.
Nat, would you please direct it to some other folks? I don't want to hog this press conference. Go ahead, Nat.
I'm just looking at the reports from Ledge Finance on the budgets that came out of the subcommittees, and I might be mistaken on this based on what you guys did here, but wondering, it looks like the cut that you just made to education, 7%, is higher than, you know, several other departments, the cuts that you guys have made. I mean, just how would you justify that to, you know, parents who are looking at this process?
It isn't a justification thing. The amount that we took from schools was 4%. Most of what we did to other agencies was around 10%. The total on the education agency, added to what the governor took out from last year's one-time money, added to the amount that came out of the formula, which we just did, that adds up to 7%. But really, the impact on schools, the education grant, the formula, the BSA, whatever, however you want to characterize it, that was only in the neighborhood of 4.1%. So that's an additive thing that comes up to 7%.
Thank you. If I could respond, it's really both to Becky and to Nat. Part of the issue that we're facing is we're looking at general fund dollars. And so when we do an overlay on a spreadsheet that shows where we actually expend general fund dollars, K through 12 and health and social services rise to the very top of that. So when we're spending general fund dollars, 26.18% of every dollar we spend is on K through 12 education, and 26.18%, and these are in large numbers, even though they're not, but just looking at a bar chart, they're fairly equal in health and social services. And then the next driver inside of Alaska's budget is 13.5% at the university. And so when we look at all of the other departments that are available to cut from, whether we take a percentage or not, the available GF dollars for us to spend is very different. And so there has to be an impact to our largest cost drivers.
I think that most schools would tell you that the education agency budget is different from the budget they get in the school district. Senator Dunleavy, you can talk about education budget.
And we worked in the subcommittee, we worked closely with the commissioner to reduce it as much as possible. We looked out and we saw this as the governor, I think, mentioned. He was looking at 16% at one time, and then there was a discussion of 25% as the total. Based upon what we know at this moment, he was looking at 25% reduction in your budget. We worked with the commissioner on education to try and get us down as close as possible to that number now, so that we don't have to go back to the department next year or the year after and add more or take more away from the department. The department, in some of their functions, certainly helps smaller school districts. There's no doubt about it. But again, the discussion was with the commissioner, I give him and his team a lot of credit. The discussion was, how can we keep as much of these cuts away from kids? We were able to do that in the subcommittee. But as was mentioned, we're also watching daily what's happening in the world market with oil. This agreement that's, we don't know the details on, coming out of Iran with the Iranian talks on the nuclear issue. If there is an agreement, there is an understanding that there probably will be a relaxation of the sanctions, which for Iran means oil. And we have a proxy war going on now in the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And as Chair Kelly said earlier in the meeting, we have to err on the side of caution right now. There may be an opportunity here to put money back in if things turn around, or there's going to be discussions with the House. But the Senate felt we had to err on the side of caution. And as Senator McKinnon said, It is what it is. Education is one of the big four or five expenditures in our state budget, as it is in most state budgets. So, I'm sure that some of us thought about dancing around the issue, and some of us thought about going somewhere else to get the cuts. But when you look at it, everybody's going to be affected by what has occurred in this catastrophic drop in oil prices. And we decided to just take it by the horns and deal with it. And as Senator Hoffman said, this is just the beginning. That's the problem. It's just the beginning. So we're sure we're not going to win any popularity points today with some members of the public. But in the end, there's got to be some tough decisions to be made, and that's why we're here.
Well, were you able to watch the last few days of amendments?
Right. I've watched the amendments, but is there some big news that's coming?
The news is what we just did. It's just the budget. There's no additional news other than it's going to the floor.
Just to follow up on her question, there was some amendment you made regarding unions and pay raises. Can you talk about that, why you made that, and how much that would save the state?
That's about a $30 million savings. And it's part of how we have to, we were in an unenviable position here this year. If to use a baseball analogy, you usually want to win baseball with base hits. We had to hit home runs, and so we were looking at things that could get us $30 million at a time, and that was one of them. And when I said, if you're alluding to what's to come, I was just referring to conference committee, and that these actions weren't available in the House. They were available. They didn't enact them in the House, so they aren't available at conference committee unless we enact them here. So that's all I was referring to there.
Are there any other actions that you could take in conference committee or have taken regarding the LIO and stripping some things down there to save the state money?
There's very few actions we can take in conference other than what will be laid out in the conference committee document that Senator McKinnon and I are the Senate members on the conference committee.
So what's the bottom line? What are the biggest
pathways
to find
artists
today in the budget that you're sending?
Can I just take a...
Sure, go ahead. I think what's clear here is that no one's immune. The cuts were largely across the board. There's not an area of the state that wasn't touched. When you're looking at a $3.5 billion shortfall, everyone in the state of Alaska is going to feel a pinch. And we've tried to be fair about it, but you'll notice we went to education, we went to health and social services, Department of Transportation, and it's not organized labor, it's labor. I mean, the fact is that our biggest cost driver in the state of Alaska is the employees. What we're trying to do is preserve jobs the best we can with this year's level of cuts, but we tried to make those cuts fairly even. We've tried to make them cuts that were done with I won't say a scalpel because, unfortunately, hard to say that with $750 million, however we end up in total. But we've been careful with the cuts. We took hours of public testimony. You saw some amendments yesterday trying to answer some of the biggest concerns in the state. And we've really done the best we can with this level of a shortfall.
Anybody else that hasn't asked a question? Oh.
We're hearing a lot about Iran today, but obviously these cuts have been in the making for a long time, and I was just wondering if you might be able to speak to these cuts outside of the events of the day, because they constantly change. We were hearing a lot about Sally Jewell's decisions in February, now we're not hearing about that. So let's put us in context.
Go ahead.
Well, so... I mean, we started trying to turn this ship around in 2013, right? The 28th legislature realized that these days were coming. I mean, you can see, even if at worst production leveled off, the fact is we were spending above what we were bringing in for revenue. So I think we started looking at what could be possible in the future, a 50% reduction in the value of our primary product. I mean, I used the Dave Ramsey analogy before. I don't know if you know who that is, but if you think about what you would do if you
had a job and someone said, you have to, you know, sorry, you're going to get a 50% pay cut. You know, you're going to cut off cable television. You're going to stop going out to dinner. You might get a second job. That's what this looks like. It's tough. I don't think these are new cuts. We knew this effort was going to be significant coming in this year. We had a target early on. Of course, you know, we started seeing the drop. By September, we were in the mid-70s. It continued downward. But by December, once the elections were over, we had a target that looks very much like today. And it's really about capital preservation and survivability. We're trying to keep from impacting future generations with debt and current generations with taxes and other burden. This is the first step. We don't have a crystal ball on the price of oil or what happens from here. This is what the first step looks like. What happens in the next 12 months is going to determine where we go from here, I think.
I need to wrap this up. Go ahead, Senator Dunleavy.
As the Senator said, we began this process last year because we started to reduce the capital budget. We knew we'd have to get to the operating budget this year. But keep in mind, last year at about this time, many of us were being called knuckleheads for some of the tax changes that we were trying to do. I've actually had people come up to me about a year ago today saying, what's wrong with you? Well, oil's going to be $180 a barrel. Obviously, that didn't happen. We've had a complete turnaround, a collapse of oil prices. It's tough to divorce what's happening in the world because we are one of the ultimate petrostates in which we have one source of income in reality for a state of 700,000 people. But we did begin to bend the curve on spending with regard to the capital budget last year. We knew we'd have to tackle this budget this year. And many of us were in conversation over the summer and the fall. Some of us were running in our races. We were looking over our shoulders at the price dropping. And we knew this discussion was going to have to happen. And we started this discussion, some of us, back in October and November. And to this Senate's credit, we actually, as the Senator Michicki was saying, we actually talked about targets. It's not going to be enough. This $700 million plus represents about 90 days of revenue or payments to run state government. And so this is just the beginning. This really is just the beginning.
Rhonda, I don't think – Matt, you haven't asked a question yet.
We talked about, the crash pad or whatever the phrase they use there. The projections are that we're not going to have this new revenue, before the money and savings are going to run out. So there's going to be next year's going to be worse when the savings are finally actually gone in a few years, like it's really bad. So. There's been talk of additional revenue. When is that coming into the picture here? I mean, how do we get, either gas online or any other formats that we've kind of heard talked about? When is that coming into the picture?
Matt, thanks for the question. I think that it comes in the picture when Alaskans understand the current fiscal situation that we're in. Certainly, the people that are contacting my office are saying cut more. That's just my constituency. They believe that there is still excess in government. They look at administrations, whether it's my school district or other bureaucracies, and I mean that with respect to all the hardworking public servants that are there, because I consider myself a public servant. And so I'm trying to reflect the values and the desires of the people who elected me. I was reading the Clarion. Senator Michicki might be able to comment on it. And I clicked on a survey that said, what do you think should be done at Alaska State Legislature? And 70% of them above said, cut more. And so the people of Alaska do not believe that we're running lean and mean. And we need to have those conversations. I think we're prepared to have those conversations this summer. But it's going to be a joint effort with the administration. And the Senate is a singular body that works in collaboration and sometime in frustration with the House of Representatives. And so, seeing that, it's two bodies that have to come together to consider and then ultimately decide how to step forward. And so the Senate is proposing that the situation is a little bit more immediate, that we need to talk about the finances of our state more directly. They've made one proposal. Ours is less than their proposal. And two, the two shall meet on a conference committee, as the co-chairman has said, and we will try to work out our differences to benefit the people of Alaska. But again, back to the question directly, the people of Alaska are going to ultimately decide when there's a conversation about revenue. Right now, they are still talking about cuts.
Rhonda, you had one question and you got cut off, so you're the last one.
All right, thanks. Can you give us a quick notes version of what you've done to the budget? Because a lot has gone back and forth these past few days. So what is the bottom line of what the public is
doing? Okay, so the governor started off with $126 million. Now, there's some argument over how you add up fund shifts and those kinds of things. What we tried to do was take the most reasonable look at it so that we weren't giving ourselves the benefit of those fund shifts and those kinds of things, that the cuts that we were going to make to achieve some goal that would develop would be cuts to the bottom line. They would be general fund cuts. So the governor started, congratulations, Governor, with a $126 million reduction general fund. The House added another 102. Subcommittees added about 10. This is to day-to-day operations. Then we had picked up some money on some formula fund lapses. There was a debt service reduction. And what we ended up with, and then the additional part that we you saw today on education and yesterday or day before on the contracts, we came up with about $350 million day-to-day operations added to the anticipated capital budget reductions. Again, that conversation is just starting. The capital budget is a little more easier to predict, and that's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of four, we think. Not sure. And that'll end up about $750 million.
Can you give me one number? Less is this budget?
750.
Than what the governor gave to you?
No. Comparing year to year.
Okay.
Yeah. That's including the capital and the operating budget, not just the
last year.
Right. From the FY 15 management.
And you know what? You would look at runs and we would disagree. Well, what about this number? What about this number? We just tried to say what's reasonable, what doesn't give us all kinds of breaks so that we have the pressure taken off us to make actual general fund reductions to the day-to-day operations of government. That's what we wanted to make as our goal, and we've hit that, and it's going to be somewhere around 750 with the capital budget. You have to qualify it with that phrase at the end.
We've used the term real money as opposed to, as the senator was saying, this is going to be a $730 to $750 real money reduction over last year, not slide from this fund to that fund, hide this, call it that. This is a real money reduction.
Yeah.
And you mentioned leverage earlier, but with the cuts to the education formula, essentially, how do you get the Democrats in the House on board with the CBR vote?
That's to be determined in the future. Go ahead. Hi, Jennifer.
Some of the unallocated cuts, departments, Department of Education are looking at personnel cuts. Will there be effort over the interim to kind of refine that process and learn how to think about making more specific cuts so that the departments have more direction in how they want to adjust?
I'm a big believer in allowing the managers to manage. I have a disagreement with some of my colleagues about the specificity of cuts. I prefer more general cuts because it throws it to the manager who has far more information than we do. We're a board of directors, and you don't see a board of directors sitting down beside the CPA for the company and going through line by line in the budget. The board of directors says, we got this much money, here's what you can spend, let us know. And that's essentially the philosophy behind unallocated reductions. As we go into the future, we have a pretty good working relationship with this OMB director, and we have the summer to talk more with her about how we can achieve what we're going to need to achieve, because they seem to agree with us. Times are tough.
Can I tell a quick
story? Senator Michiki?
I just wanted to, just so for a quick comparison, I had two of the
four largest budgets, so the Department of Transportation, Health and Social Services this year for subcommittees, and very different experiences, and I've been a manager and I've been managed and I know how different styles are. With Department of Transportation, we largely said, and in both cases I said I want to do this with you and not to you. Department of Transportation was very forthcoming, had some great suggestions. It was a different experience than it was with Hess. Hess, and they're all great people. I mean, they're protecting the services that they provide, but they were a little bit more hesitant to give suggestions. So we put more in unallocated cuts to give them a little bit more leverage later. Two different styles. I actually think the best outcome is clearly the Department of Transportation, and it's certainly the experience I'd like to have more so in the future. But it's going to, these relatively speaking were easy cuts, and I don't want to say easy because I'm sweating right now. This has been a very difficult process for me. We believe in these services. There's no one up here rubbing their hands together saying this is a great experience cutting these budgets, but the next round will be very difficult because we'll be looking at core services where we'll have to be partnered with department heads on where these next rounds can go next year.
We're going to cut it off here. We've got another group that's coming in, and we have to get the tables ready.
We can hook you up with them. Let's count them now.
Oh. We're on at 6.
Senate Finance Committee is back in session. We're adjourned.